Last time we started on Rav Shri Ragon, gave you the basic bio, born in the year 906 roughly, lives to be 100 years old, passes away roughly the year 1006. Av Beis Din, first in Pumbedisa, becomes the Gaon of the yeshiva in Pumbedisa. And the main focus with him is the fact that he is a Gaon who has a major role in our halachic Mesorah, first of all. We talked about, I gave you examples of tshuvos where he's quoted halachic works that he's quoted in. But he's also quoted by standard commentators to Tanakh. Radak quotes him, Ramban quotes him. He's also a strong rationalist, which emerges in his writing. We talked about that last time. But he's best known, and this is what I wanted to do this time, is he's best known for something we've already talked about somewhat, the Igeres of Rav Shri Ragon, his famous letter. And we've introduced it before, so I'm not going to go into it at length, but the Jewish community in Kairouan, right? Kairouan is Carthage, it's in Tunisia, writes away to him because they need guidance. They need a response to primarily Karaites regarding the history of Torah. Where did, especially Torah Shebaal Peh, where did that come from? So last time when we introduced Rav Shri Ragon, we gave the questions that they asked him. So they asked if the Mishnah is ancient, going all the way back to the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, why are all the names in the Mishnah the students of Rabbi Akiva? Why is it that we paskin like this last generation of Tanoim, when you had all these great Tanoim, we didn't even know their names, who were before? They asked about the order of the Masechtos in Shas and why some of them are counterintuitive. They asked how it is that we have Mishnah, which is what Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi compiles in the beginning of the 3rd century, or canonizes in the beginning of the 3rd century, but there are texts that are contemporary to the Mishnah that end up in a separate work called the Tosefta. And there are other texts from that time that don't end up in the Tosefta, but end up being quoted in the Gemara as what are called Brisos, like, where did they come from? These are basic questions that they want to know, because you have Karaites saying, you rabbis, you know, made all this stuff up and it's not authoritative, so where did we get all this from? That's what they put to him. So he writes a response, or really two responses, two letters. One of them is a major letter, and then another kind of an addendum afterwards. There are multiple editions of what has survived to this day from the letter of Rav Shri Ragon. That's not so surprising. A letter like this, first of all, just understanding how the letters, you know, worked in general when they wrote something like this. I believe his son, Rav Haigon, was involved, but they also had Sofrim who were involved when they wrote tshuvos, when they wrote like specific practical rulings. Often they involved others in the process of coming to the conclusion and actually drafting the letter. So there could be a lot of reasons why we have multiple editions. The editions don't disagree as much as supplement each other.
How far were they from him?
Far. He is in Pumbedisa, which is Fallujah in Iraq. They're in Tunisia. So if you think of, like, just from the sand, of the North African coast, right? It's in my head because I taught a class yesterday about the Rif and Morocco. So the North African coast, you've got Morocco in the west, then you've got Algeria, then you've got Tunisia, then you've got Libya, and then you have Egypt, right? And then you move up the coast and east further, and you get Iran, Iraq, like they're further out. So quite a distance.
How do they know that he was their address?
Because he's the Gaon. Right? We've been talking all about it. The Gaonic system by this point has been around for three centuries.
So they're just used to this, like sending away their questions so far.
Right. One of the things that I always find fascinating about this whole period of time and looking back on it is, like, you know, we've learned about, I think, five of the Gaonim, I think, maybe six. And we sort of sandwich this whole era into these Gaonim and make it sound like it's a brief period. Like, this is a period of time that takes 300 to 400 years. Go back 300 to 400 years in terms of human history. You know, go back to whatever you want to, you know, whatever landmark you want to pick. But beginning of the 16th century, beginning of the 17th century, beginning of the 18th century, you're talking Enlightenment, you're talking about a vastly different world. And realize that the Jews are living through this entire 300 to 400 year period with basically the same system of we have a yeshiva, or multiple yeshivot, and you have a gaon who's the head of it, and this is where you go if you have questions. And I do it because my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather did it. Right. You know, it's just, this is the way Torah works. It's mind-boggling to think about what that's like.
And the reverence of that, of never having your own person within your own community that you think you can just ask.
Right, so Kairouan did. Right? Kairouan has a yeshiva with somebody who gets the title at times as a gaon. I think this is Rabbi Yaakov ben Nissim Gaon, I think. But always subsidiary to Bavel. You may remember when we learned about the Baal Halachos Gedolos, we talked about influence at the time from Israel and from the yeshiva there, and how the yeshiva in Bavel felt like the influence that was coming from the yeshiva in Israel was actually entirely authentic and was a problem. There was a student of Rabbi Yehuda Gaon who wrote a letter about it and, you know, argued that they were getting things wrong as a result of it. So Kairouan, and certainly Israel in the eyes of Bavel and the eyes of much of the Jewish world, were, yeah, they're nice, but not, you know, no one matches Sura, Pumbedisa, Matamachsia, those yeshivas. Yeah. Nehama, you were going to say something before?
No, I was wondering, because it took so long for the back and forth, were they limited? Would they have been able to come up with new things or things to write? Had they had more access? Had things been happening a lot quicker? Or they weren't limited to that?
No, I, you know.
Responses or this, or one had nothing to do with the other.
No, I mean, I do think if you have the greater access you have, the more questions you're going to ask, and the greater the possibility of, you know, learning more and developing more. But this was their world.
Mm-hmm. And what you're saying is, as the world around them were evolving, they continued to stick with the yeshiva institution type of an idea. They weren't changing.
I don't think the world around them was evolving either. I think, you know, things are fairly static at that period of time. This is the period that for the general world becomes known as the Dark Ages. You know, this is an era when you don't have a lot of intellectual ferment. Maybe you have in the Arab world somewhat. You have in the Arab world somewhat of it, but you're not seeing a lot of evolution. You're seeing war. There's war going on, but empires in the Arab world, empires are rising and falling. In the Christian world, not so much. In the Christian world, you're seeing the Byzantine Empire, and, you know, they're pretty dominant, but you're not looking at a lot of change and a lot of turmoil in terms of, their society either. That's my understanding. So he sets out in Igeres Rav Shira Gaon critical elements of our history. He gives principles, like how the Mishnah was created, and details, the names of the Savarim, the names of the Gaonim. And each time he presents an idea, he gives you passages from the Gemara to support it. It's very clear that he wants you to know it from the sources. So if you take a look at number one, I translated a chunk of it that addresses the question of how the Mishnah was written and why we only know the names of the later generations. There is, I mentioned to you, when we first talked about Gaonim, like when we started the series, basically, I started, I think, by quoting a little bit of Igeres Rav Shrira Gaon back then. And I mentioned to you then that there is a translated version of Igeres Rav Shrira Gaon out there, at least one that's available. And it's the sort of thing which, when I was in high school, I don't remember which year anymore, but a Rebbe of ours like recommended, like, you know, you guys should have this and should read it. And of course we bought it and didn't read it. But I wish I had, because it would have given me some interesting things to think about. But nonetheless, if you take a look at the first source, and we'll just go with my translation, but you can see the original there as well. He says, we see that certainly the six orders of Mishnah, right? The six orders of Mishnah, you know, Mishnah is made up of six sort of, we call them orders in English, in Hebrew we call them, sdarim, right? Zraim, right? Dealing mostly with agriculture. Moed, dealing with mostly with Shabbos and holidays. Nashim, dealing with issues of marriage, divorce. Nezikin, tort law, damages, that kind of thing. Kadshim, dealing with karbanos and shchita. And then taharos, dealing with purity and impurity. That's basically, and some variation within. So he says, these six orders of the Mishnah Rabbeinu HaKadosh established them as he learned them, law after law, and one should neither add nor subtract. Rabbeinu HaKadosh is Rebbe, also known as Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. And so he quotes you the Gemara in Yevamos, which asks, when was Mishnah established? In the days of Rebbe. So then he says, regarding your question, why did they leave the earlier great ones for the later? Meaning, so why is it that we're getting the, you know, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, and we don't know anything about those who lived 100 years before them? They did not leave the earlier greater ones for the later, but all of them learned the matters of the earlier ones and studied their reasons. They were learning what had been said before them. For when Hillel the Elder, this is a great story, this is a story that justifies what Jewish communities go through, like on an annual basis. You know how you hit, let's say, a particular Yom Tov, and you can't remember, how did we do it last year? Like we used to have, when I was growing up, we had a debate every Sukkos. Do we sit in the Sukkah on Shmini Atzeres? Do we make Kiddush in the Sukkah?
Yes.
Until finally one year, my father took his machzor and he wrote in, this is what we do, and that way we would know. So this comes up in the Jewish world every time you hit Shabbos being Erev Pesach. Right? When Erev Pesach calls out on Shabbos, everyone's, like, they completely forgot what's supposed to happen because of the way the Luach works. It happens, and then it happens again a few years later, like 3 or 4 years later, and then it doesn't happen for another 15 years. That's the way it works. So everyone, you know, has to reinvent the wheel and look back at the publications and debate the same debates all over again. It happened a couple of years ago. It's going to happen again in another 2 years,
not
I think.
Not this year?
It's either next year or the year after, I forget. It's either 2 years from now or three, I forget. But in any case, this is the story in the Gemara. The story in the Gemara is that one year, Erev Pesach was Shabbos, and this is the time of the Beis HaMikdash, and no one remembers how to handle Shechita for the Korban Pesach. How do you get the knife to the Beis HaMikdash? You can't carry the knife. So there's like the whole big debate, and Hillel says, go see what people do. And they go out and they look, and people do.
I was just gonna say, bring it beforehand.
For everybody who has to shecht a Korban Pesach, you don't have one person shechting Korban Pesach. Everybody's doing it.
I don't know. Everybody brings their shoes.
Yes, I bring my shoes to
school
if there's a.
But you don't
have a
back of
pair of shoes at home.
No, like the, you know, the
you have thousands. Wait, you have thousands of knives, which you're gonna sort out how.
Why can't there just be a pile of knives for people to use?
Like, because if there's
a... It seems like we're creating a problem.
In any case, the way that it happened was that they watched what people did, and what people did was they put the knife into the wool of the sheep, and then the sheep walks to the Beis HaMikdash with them, and the sheep is carrying... No, it's not cute. It's cannibalistic. It's terrible.
You mean they stab the sheep? No.
No. It's just like the sheep is carrying its own sheep knife.
Oh, yeah. That's
a little bit... Yeah.
How is that okay?
So, because the sheep is doing the carrying, you're not carrying the sheep. The sheep
but
is walking.
But it's for you. You're benefiting from it.
Yeah, that's okay.
Why is it different than like
that's
someone
fine.
Pushing the stroller? Someone they can't push the stroller with your baby in it.
No. No, that's true. I can't ask a non-Jew. I have no rule that my animal can't engage in whatever it wants to. I can't make the animal do malacha, but the animal can. I have, for example,
when did they put a knife into the sheep?
Before.
Yeah. On Friday.
Actually, maybe on Shabbos. I don't know. I don't. I just go back and look.
Tricky, like,
I wasn't planning on talking about this Gemara.
Just
happened
to
be here.
Right.
So
that's what I'm saying. Why is it okay that the sheep is carrying something that you're benefiting from? How is it different? Because it's an animal.
Hang on. There's nothing wrong with the sheep carrying something that you are benefiting from. That's not a thing. That's
no, but
not
how
an
is
issue.
That still not carrying? How is it different than like?
Because you're not carrying, and you are not talking about carrying. It's
no,
not.
Because it's an animal.
There's an issue against telling a non-Jew to do malacha for you on Shabbos. It's generally assumed that it's a derabanan.
Okay.
And there are multiple reasons for it, none of which will apply when you're talking about the animal doing it. I'm not allowed to make my animal do malacha on Shabbos. However, if I have an animal that eats grass and my animal goes outside and decides to chew grass, there's nothing wrong with afraiding grass from the ground on Shabbos.
Right.
So going back to our discussion, at this point, Hillel is appointed as the Nasi. Hillel is elevated to the position of Nasi. And that's the only reason this is here. Not because of Erev Pesach on Shabbos, and not because of Shechita knives and whatnot. When Hillel the Elder was appointed by the B'nai B'Sera as the Nasi over them, he said to them, "What caused this for you that I should be the Nasi over you? How is it that I became the Nasi? You were the Nasi, whichever of them was." And he says, "It's because of your laziness. You did not serve the two giants of the generation, Shmaya and Avtalion. Shmaya and Avtalion are the Rebbeim of Hillel. You didn't learn from them.
You would have learned. You wouldn't need me.
You wouldn't need me. Exactly. So he's bringing it. Rosh Hashanah is bringing this in order to make a statement of, you need to learn from the earlier generations. And that's what they did. They did learn from the earlier generations. And he says, such was the case that the early sages, their names are not known, only the names of the Nasi and the Abbezdin alone, those we do know, like in Pirkei Avos, when you get those initial Mishnayos, where you have the two names, Yossi ben Yochanan, Yossi ben Sreda, Nitai Arbelian, all of those the pairings, the Nasi and the Abbezdin. Why don't we know all the other sages? Because there was no debate between them. How do you get recognized? How does everybody know who you are? Because you disagreed with somebody. That's the way it works. But all the logic of the Torah were known to them clearly. All the logical points that you find, all the different arguments, they had it all clear. They knew the entire Talmud clearly, the questions and fine points in their Mishnah on every issue, as taught in Bava Basra. When he says Talmud, he doesn't mean the canonized Shas that we think of. He means the learning, the halachos, that would ultimately become Talmud. So he says, they're not recording names because there's no purpose to recording names. No one's disagreeing. Everyone is sitting there and they're learning the same Torah and they're learning the same halacha and everybody knows the same thing. And as long as the Beis HaMikdash stood, each of the sages taught the students the logic of the Torah and Mishnah and Talmud and lessons he composed for them in his day. And they taught their students appropriately. When Shammai and Hillel came, they only debated 3 points, he says. As the Gemara in Shabbos says, Rav Huna said, in 3 places, Shammai and Hillel argued. We always think of these great debates, Hillel and Shammai. They only disagreed on 3 things. That's all you got.
The menorah, what else?
Right, that's Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, is the menorah. It's debate. The students of Hillel and Shammai end up with a lot of disagreements, which he attributes to 2 things. Number one, he attributes the growth of debate to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, where we get scattered in all these different places. And then later on, we're going to mention it in a bit, to the destruction of Beitar and the loss of the students of Rabbi Akiva. And that, again, leads to a lot of confusion and a lot of debate because you don't have all the people learning together that are going to enable you to keep one consolidated tradition. At that point, you start to get disputes. So he says, when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed and they went to Beitar, Beitar being Bar Kokhba's last stronghold, and Beitar was also destroyed, and the rabbis scattered in every direction, and because of those disruptions and destructions and confusions at that time, the students did not serve as needed. They didn't serve their rebbeim as they needed to in order to get everything straight, and debates grew. That's what causes machlokas. But until that time, there's no reason to record Rabbi so-and-so says. Because it wasn't Rabbi so-and-so who said it. It was everybody who said it. You follow? That's what he explains. Now he has something particularly interesting.
But before that time, they were still writing things down. They just weren't saying whose name was in.
They were still, like, so they're not writing. There's no reason to write.
You only start writing and naming people after all of the scattering.
Right. You do find in the Gemara mention of something called Megillas Starim, hidden texts, where individual halachos may have been recorded by a particular chacham to make sure that he would remember something. But it wasn't published. There's nothing that's being, it's a distinction of recording versus publishing. So take a look at number 2, because this is fascinating to me. I had never noticed this point. He's going on to discuss the tradition that we have, and he says, Umasa Rabbi Akiva is atzmo lahariga, acha sheniftar Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma. Rabbi Akiva gave himself up to be executed, right, by the Romans. After Rabbi Yosef ben Kisma died, v'nerag Rabbi Chanina ben Tragion, and Rabbi Chanina ben Tragion was killed, right? That's the famous story. They wrap him in the Sefer Torah. That's Rabbi Chanina ben Tragion. V'nismata ha'chochma achareihem. And after that, knowledge shrinks, just because you've lost all of these big figures. V'hemid Rabbi Akiva talmidim harbe. Rabbi Akiva established many students. Bahava shmada al hatalmidim shal Rabbi Akiva. There was destruction upon the students of Rabbi Akiva. Vava samcha di Yisrael al hatalmidim shniim shal Rabbi Akiva. And Israel relied upon Rabbi Akiva's second students. You know the story, right? What happened to the students of Rabbi Akiva? The first batch?
They died.
How did they die?
A plague
is what the Gemara says. The Gemara in Yavamos tells us that there was a plague, and it was because they didn't treat each other with respect, right? That's the classic story.
Correct.
So, years ago, I heard the suggestion that it was actually the Bar Kokhba revolt, because Rabbi Akiva was the main supporter of Bar Kokhba in the world of the Tanaim, and Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim got involved in this revolt against the Romans, and the Romans came along and they massacred the students of Rabbi Akiva. Which explains a lot.
Yeah, that actually sucks.
It explains a lot in terms of just the idea that all of his students were wiped out in a plague. I mean, if you take it as Hashem's punishment, then that's what happens, and you know, things like that do happen. But in terms of our commemoration of that tragedy over any other tragedy, it is strange. But I always wondered.
Why would it say that it was a plague?
Right. So I always wondered about that, right? Mm-hmm. The reason why you wouldn't want to say what it was is because you're living under the Romans.
Interesting.
You're going to start memorializing this, the Romans who are still ruling the Jews for a few centuries after that event, are not going to take to it well.
Do you mean because I think they're going to get catchy?
Yeah, I mean, they're going to say, these Jews are a dangerous group. They're going to rebel against us. That's always been the argument. That was the Babylonians. Mm-hmm. That was the Persians. That was, you know. So that's number one, is the fear of what the Romans will do. So therefore, we conceal what this is really about. This is not the only date on the Jewish calendar for which that allegation is made, that there's other stuff going on behind the scenes. In terms of why the day is commemorated the way it is.
What are other examples?
The 9th of Teves. We have various midrashim that talk about the 8th, 9th, 10th of Teves as being terrible days. The 10th of Teves, we know, that's the Babylonian siege of Yerushalayim. But what it was that happened on the 8th and 9th is unclear. There are associations with the death of Ezra. There are associations with the recording of the Torah in Greek. Under Ptolemy, but there are all sorts of interesting ideas that are sort of beneath the surface that percolate. Professor Schneer Lyman is well known for having argued that there was one of the Tanoim who mixed into the early Christians in order to sabotage their attempts to draw Jews. In other words, the early Christians claimed to the Jews, we are the real Jews, and you should be coming with us. And one of the Tanoim mixed in to get them to actually become more Christian and less Jewish. I mean, it's basically an attempt to make them so different from us, like, hey, you guys do Sunday instead of Shabbos type thing, in order that Jews should not be drawn after it. And his yahrzeit is, I forget if it's the 8th or the 9th. That's like one of the arguments. It's a whole thing. That's a shiur in its own right. But that's an example of, like, stories about some of the lesser-known dates on the Jewish calendar. Yeah. But what's interesting here, and I had never noticed it, but I heard this from Dr. Henry Abramson, who actually was in town. He was at Shari Shemayim. Dean of... No, is he a Tura? I don't think he's a Tura. I don't know. He's a historian. He actually grew up in Northern Ontario, interestingly. He has a lot of great material on Jewish history. I first learned about him when I read an article of his like 20-something years ago. He had an article about Beis Medrash life, basically. And it was beautiful. It was a fantastic article. But in any case, he pointed out that what Rosh Hashanah Gaon says here happened was v'hava shmada al hatalmidim shel Rabbi Akiva. There was shmad upon the students of Rabbi Akiva. Shmad only has two meanings, right? Sometimes shmad means assimilation, but usually shmad is like lashmid laharog ulabed, right? To kill, to destroy. It's not a plague. It's an attack. And this may be a hint at what actually happened. to the students of Rabbi Akiva, embedded in Igeres Rav Shira Gaon, which, you know, people don't read and therefore they don't know. Okay, last piece that we're going to see from the Igeres is source number 3, where he talks about why Rebbe canonized the Mishnah. He says, and I'm just going to jump to my translation. And all through the time of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, his son, Rabbeinu HaKadosh, grew up in Torah study. Quoting the Gemara in Bava Metzia, Pei Dalet, when Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha sat on the benches, Rebbe and Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon, sat before them and asked and answered. You have to remember that the line of Rebbe, right, the line of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, is the line from David, but it's also the line from Hillel. And there are a bunch of names that keep getting recycled in the line, specifically Shimon and Gamliel. Uh-huh.
Yes.
So there are three Rabbi Gamliels, and there are two or three Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliels. So Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is the son of one of the Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliels.
Isn't there also a Shimon, a Gamliel, and then another Shimon? Like, isn't that like a father's son and then a Shimon ben Gamliel?
So I forget exactly how it works. But basically, yes, that's the line.
Why did it take him so long to come up with last names? Like, it would have just been simpler.
I don't know. What title? So Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel is learning, and his son, Rebbe, is in front of him. And Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon, who is the son of Rabbi Shimon by Yochai, is there as well. And Rebbe served those sages. He did the Shimush. He was a close Talmud. As Rebbe said, when we learned beside Rabbi Shimon in Tekoa, etc. And he learned the laws of the Mishnayos from them. So Rebbe is absorbing this tradition. And when he reigned after his father, he was with the sons of those sages, like Rabbi Shmuel, son of Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yossi, son of Yehuda, Rabbi Yaakov of Farchitaya, and other students like Rabbi Chia, who ascended from Babel, Rabbi Chanina Bar Chama, Rabbi Ephes, Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Shimon, sons of Rabbeinu HaKadosh, Rabbi Yanai, and they spread much Torah. And throughout those years, all of the laws which depended on all of the Midrashim meaning drashos on the text of the Torah, were explained out of fear of the great loss of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Meaning they're examining all of the underpinnings of halacha. And because of the doubts they had in those upheavals, in that time of upheaval, a lot of questions are raised. And all of the debates born in those three generations were ruled upon. And the words of individuals and of the majority were known among them once the sages made great efforts in that regard and they made great analyses until they produced what those early sages said and what they did until they resolved all their doubts. They're going through all the debates and all the questions and trying to hash everything out. But the early ones had not written anything down. And none of the early ones wrote anything until the end of the time of Rabbeinu HaKadosh, meaning he does not believe that Mishnah was a cross-generational process that Rebbe simply said, okay, now is the time for us to conclude it. He says it's an invention of
that
period, that generation. And so too, they did not teach all of them with one mouth and one expression. Those earlier Chachamim, the Tanan, weren't all teaching it the same way. But they knew their reasons, and all of them had one view, and there was no conflict in their learning. They knew what was universally held, and what was debated, and what was an individual's view, and what was a collective view. They didn't have anything set with a known Mishnah that all of them would learn with one mouth and one expression. But those reasons and lessons they knew. Even though all the sages agreed upon them, each of them taught it to his students in whatever composition he chose, and in any way he chose. The lessons that they knew, they would each teach their students in whatever way they wanted to. And because of this, they explained in the Gemara, whose is that? Here's the lesson. Who is the author of that lesson? Oh, that's Rabbi Ploni. And we say, who authored that which the rabbis taught, etc.? Who is this like? That sage. And we say in various places, the one who taught this lesson didn't teach that lesson. Because they were all teaching it differently. And when Rebbe saw that there was such variety in what the sages taught, even though their arguments all went to the same point, he was concerned and he said, okay, I need to write this. So that's Rav Shira Gaon, who is broadcasting this message to the Jews in Tunisia so that they'll actually have some understanding of where their Masorah came from.
Yeah, because context is everything.
Yeah.
So,
so that's Rav Shira Gaon. There's obviously more that you can say about him, but yeah, in particular about what he did to rejuvenate Pumbedisa in his day, which was a big deal. And what I wanted to do next is to go on to Rav Haigon and Rav Haigon will take a little bit more time in terms of explaining what happened in Pumbedisa, but I looked at the time and realized we actually need to start on Parsha. I thought we were going to start on Rav Haigon today, but it's not going to happen. It's too bad. Rav Haigon is incredible. Yeah, God willing, we'll talk about Rav Haigon next week.
Is this the accepted view of the Mishnah? Like, after Rav Shira wrote this letter, everybody's like, this is how the Mishnah went.
Yeah. More or less. I mean, you will see modern historians who will question aspects of it, without a doubt. But
how
this
could it
is
have been and blah blah like that.
Yeah, and could it have been done in one generation? Cross generational and things like that. Yeah.
Why does that matter so much to people if it was one generation or cross generational?